So tonight is the tonight is January 19th. 19th or 20th?
19th.
January 19th. And this is the eighth lecture, and we're doing the 1500s in Europe. Tonight we're going to be talking about the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles. He probably would be like the zenith, the height of the greatness of Poland. It's not really fair to say because Poland was great and has been Poland and Lita, Lithuania, was really the leaders of Torah, you know, and the learning of Torah, the center of Torah learning, up until, I guess, our day, up until the right before World War II. But what I mean is the zenith in terms of Poland when it was an attractive place for the Jews. We're going to, I guess, eventually get to the all good things come to an end, but in the mid-1600s, we're going to speak about the Tach V'Tat, which is Chmiel Nievski's, if I'm saying his name right, his uprising, and it just was terrible for the Jews. But before that, for the first 150 years, from the 1500s to 1648, that was the, I guess, honeymoon for the Jews. This was a time where the king and the nobles were interested in having Jews, and it was a time when the Jews were able to. It was an affluent society. We mentioned last time that the Jews moved from like 50,000 in the beginning of 1500, but by the 1600s, it was like 500,000. It was by far the largest Jewish community in the world. I even heard somewhere that it was like about half of the Jewish, if it was half the Jewish people in the world, that means there was only about 1 million Jewish people in the world, and it just very well could be. But it was definitely by far the largest, by far, the Jewish community. And in that time, you had the Ramah. So I just, a lot of what I got from Rev Irons. He's a Rosh Kollel in Detroit, and he has tapes, so I got from him and from others. But I was looking recently, at this book. It's called the Ramah. It was put out by CIS, which went out of business. So, but this is a book that it's a very interesting book. I found it, especially now that I read up on the Ramah. So he paints a nice picture. You know, we spoke what the fair looks like. So he, basically, it's a historical fiction. And, like, he'll make conversations between the Ramah and his wife and Ramah and other Dayanim. And he makes, like, a story out of the history. And he does, I thought he did a great job. Now that I read all up about the Ramah, and I read this, so I thought it was great. I'll just open up with like a story he gives, and he writes in some chapters are called Stories They Told. So every so often they go to stories. This is a story that they give to Ramah. This is like such a cute story. This is a story I would say over to the kids. This is a great story to say over to the kids. Is it true or not? I don't know, but he says it that it happened with the Ramah. Hold on 1 second. Hi, Rabbi Palgan. Yeah, Baruch Hashem, I was able to get the key. I got everything. So I'm in the middle of the class now. All right, Kolto, thank you for calling back. Take care, bye. So he gives a great story. He says like this. He says there was one time a man knocked on the Ramah's door. It's probably, you could like a fill in the guddle, but he comes to the Ramah. He says he spent Shabbos by a Jew's house here, and he gave him before Shabbos, he gave him a lot of money. And after Shabbos, he asked him for his money back, his money pouch, and the guy totally denied it. So the Ramah asked him, well, do you have witnesses? He says, no. Did you get a petek? No. He says, look, he looked like a frum guy. And like, I trusted him. So the Ramah says, okay, like, you know, I can't do anything without calling in the inn or the host. I don't know if he was an owner of an inn. So he calls him in. And he starts talking to him, and he says, you know, what happened? He claims that he gave you money. He says, no, he must be mistaken. He gave me his boots to polish, but I don't know, maybe he's making a mistake between boots. And so I don't, I really don't, you know. So the Ramah had a sense of the way this person was talking that he pretty much had the money. But how do you prove it? You know, the halacha is, it's a cut and dry halacha, is that he swears that he doesn't have the money and he gets off free. So he's looking at it, he says, wow, that's an interesting watch that you have. I guess back then in the 1500s, the watches were. He says, oh, yes, take a look. This is a beautiful watch. He says, can I see it? And the Ramah looks at it. He says, wow, this is really nice. And they start talking about the watch. The Ramah says, can I show this watch to my wife? Yeah, she would really love to see this watch. And the man's like honored. He says, yeah, sure. So the Ramah goes in the back. Instead of going to his wife, he calls and gets quickly one of his students. He says, take this watch to this man's house, knock on the door, tell his wife that he wants the pouch, the money pouch, that he got Erev Shabbos from this man, and the proof that the husband sent you is, here's the watch.
Ooh, cute.
Wow. So, you know, in the meantime, the Ramah's in the back, and he leaves, you know, the host in the front there with this other guy, and he's, like, learning, and about, I guess, 15, 20 minutes later, the man comes back with the pouch. So he takes the pouch, puts it in his pocket, comes back out, and he says, well, boy, thank you so much for the watch. I'm sorry it took so long. So he says, let me get this straight. He says, okay, so you deny totally everything of it. He says, yes, I deny. He didn't give me a pouch. So the Ramah says, would you be willing to swear? And the guy says, sure, absolutely, I'd be willing to swear. So the Ramah is not going to make him swear, but the Ramah pulls out the pouch, and he says, you know, you're going to swear about this? And the other guy screams, that's my pouch! That's mine! So basically he says to the guy, he says, you know, you better keep your mouth closed about this. I will if you will. And you better not even give your wife a hard time about this. Now get out of here. Anyway, that's one of the stories it brings over here. It brings a story as we go on. Now, I don't know if it's true or not, but that's like an example of like he'll throw in things about the Ramah. All right. There's a Sifri that says many people died at living a long life. It says Moshe, these four died at 120 years. Moshe Rabbeinu, Hillel, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Akiva. The following peers died at the same age: Rivka and Kahas, which is Levi's son. They died at 133. Levi and Amram is Moshe's father. They died at 137. Yosef and Yeshua died at 110. Shmuel Ha'anavi and Shlomo HaMelech died at 52. And, okay, these are 120. So, the reason why we're bringing this in is he brings the Medrash. It says, sometimes people live a long life and they die and they learn so much. And then people live a short life and they don't live as long. So, like, how does Hashem view it? You would think that Hashem, oh, he learned like 50 years or 70 years, he'll get more schar than that person who had a short life and lived only a short amount of time. But he says it's not true. It brings a pasuk in Keheles. In English, it's sweet as the sleep of the one who toiled, whether he ate little or much. Okay, in other words, and the reason why I'm bringing this in is because Rav Moshe Isserles lived a very short life. I think the maximum, they're trying to figure out how long he lived, they guess is somewhere between 42 and 44 years. That's how long he lived. Okay, this is the same, this is that same Medrash. Okay, now just who was, this is the Tshuvas Marshal. I should just say, I'm not sure if we're going to do Marshal next week. Marshal is Rabbi Shlomo Luria. He was also, there were two great, great Rabbanim in Poland at the same time. It was the Marshal, who was much older than the Ramah. They also happened to have been good friends. They were cousins, and they always wrote back and forth. They were as different as night and day. It's almost like Hillel and Shammai. Marshal came across as the Shammai, And the Rama was like a Hillel. We'll see, like Mamash states, that's where they came across as one another. So the Marshal writes, this was sent to me, this question was sent to me by my relative, who is young yet wise, Rav Moshe Isserles. And he writes about Rav Moshe Isserles, the Marshal, who is the otherwise known as the Marshal, because he has a parish in the Gemara. All standard Gemaras have the Marshal in the back. They have the Marsha, the Marshal, and the Maram all together. He's also wrote a sefer, the Yam Shel Shlomo, which is, you know, a halachic sefer on Shas, is also unbelievable. He writes, he says, he's like arguing on the Rama, and he writes like this: I would not pay any attention, even if you, if you would bring me all these other people, for you, the master, due to your clear intellect, are in my eyes the equal of any of the latter-day great authorities. Only if you would find your position supported by a passage of Talmud or the ruling of the Gaonim would I admit to the veracity of your position. And I would do so without being embarrassed. You know, this is the way they talk about each other. But he says, he says, you could bring me anybody you want that argues on me. I hold that you're greater than any of them. So I you're greater than them. But if you want me to believe that, you got to show me from either an early Rishon and a Gaon or from the Gemara, then I'll change my position. But the fact the way he talks about the Rama in this way, there's a Chidah. The Chidah wrote a sefer called Shema Gedolim, and it's like a little biography of all Gedolim. So you can get a lot of information from them. And he wrote a biography about the Rama. And he writes, he says, he writes, he was never there, but he writes that the tombstone of the Rav Moshe Isserles is, he says, on the 33rd day of the Omer, in the year 5333, at the age of 33, did the Rama died. So it's not true. So how did he get this? Somebody who was in Krakow came to the Chidah and says, this is what it said on the tombstone. Now, either he didn't read it correctly or, you know, they're playing telephone, but it's not true. The only thing that's true is that he died on Lag BaOmer. That's true. But I think he died in 5332, and he did not die. It's impossible for him to die at the age of 33. I heard from an elderly man who testified that he was in the Holy Community in 5333. Okay, maybe it was 5333. I thought it was a year earlier. And a prestigious man arose and tested. So they were not sure if Lag BaOmer, did they say Tzidka Din? And he says one of the men there got up and said that they heard from the Rama himself that on a very, very chashuv person, on a big Talmud Chacham, you would say Tzidka Din. And they said it. Okay, Rav Moshe Isserles, but it could not have been that. I mean, we have a case where, if he was born, they have a case where he put somebody in cherem for an issue. But if he was 33 years old when he died, he did it like 20 years earlier. That means he would have been 10 years old when he put somebody in cherem. Now, that's, you know, really, you know, not really shayach. I mean, even a child prodigy. But at the age of 20, 22, he was already the leader of the Krakow jury. So then already, 10 years later than that, 41, 42, he could have been... Okay. Some of the things... The Tzemach David was a Talmud of the Rama, and he also wrote a little bit of a historical sefer. So he wrote that a bunch of things about the Rama. First of all, he wrote a sefer Toras Olas, Toras HaOla, Toras HaChatas. He also wrote glosses on the Shulchan Aruch, which is the Rama, known as the Mappa, established many disciples. Okay, so we're going to go through each of his accomplishments. Again, he lived till 42 and maybe 44, but what he did in his lifetime was truly amazing. On his gravestone, what does it say? The Western Light, the Great Goan, it says he did die on the 33rd day of the Omer. And I was right, it was 5332, a year earlier. The glory of Israel was exiled. Moshe, the shepherd, the flock of Israel, he executed justice. He spread Torah, he established disciples. But here's one line that they put on the gravestone, and this is not said by too many people, but it says, from Moshe to Moshe, no one arose like Moshe. The last person they said this about was the Rambam, right? From Moshe Rabbeinu to Moshe, the Rambam, lo kum kamosha. May Moshe had Moshe lo kum kamosha. And they said this, they wrote this about Rav Moshe Isserles from the Rambam, also about as many, well, not as many years, but Rambam passed away in the beginning of the 1200s till the 1500s, almost 1600, so that's about 350 years. That's what they said. You know, the next person I heard they said this about was the Chassam Sofer, Rav Moshe Sofer. And then the next person they said this about was Rav Moshe Feinstein. Right. So, I mean, I heard it about these four. Right, maybe, you know, by now they say it about everybody, but I don't know. But at least I've heard it said about these four. Okay, it's befitting to say about you from Moshe. He actually, the Marshal himself said it in the tshuva that may Moshe had Moshe lo kum kamosha. You can see the respect, and you hear the way they talk, the love that they had from one another. Now, the Ramah was such a humble, modest person. And if you see the way he writes, this is in Tshuva Sarama 10. He says, it was made on Sunday, the fourth veil. These are the words of the novice who wishes to drink, who wishes to cling to the dust of the scholars and to drink with thirst their words. I express my position to be a servant of the most minor of them. Again, this is the way he's... At this point, he's the chief rabbi of Poland, but this is how he talks. Also, it was a court case that came before some of the judges, Rev Landau, Rev Katz. Because of the pressure of the time, they had nobody else. They were stuck, so they got me. They appointed me to be the third member. I am the most inadequate of them all. Again, that's the way he talked. That's the way he was in terms of the way he... his writings and the way he spoke to people. He was, again, a very modest, soft, you know, his positions he held strong if he was right. But the way he talked about himself was very, very humble, very modest. Okay, he was in the yeshiva of Shalom Shachna. I don't know if we mentioned it last time, but the first Rav that came to Poland that made Poland, like, in terms of a Makom Torah was Rav Palak, Rav Yaakov Palak. We mentioned last time he had a troublesome life. He had the Machlokasim with Yibam and with the Maram Mipadua. Rav Mintz. So he had, and he actually, the end of his life, he had to run for his life because the king demanded that he do something that he felt he couldn't, and he ran for his life. So the last 10 years of his life, he was on his own. His student, his number one student was Rav Shalom Shachna. And Rav Shalom Shachna, he saw the Ramah. Ramah went to learn in his yeshivas. Ramah was there, I think, from the age of 13. When the Ramah turned 19, 18, 19, 20, so he married Rav Shachna's daughter. So Rav Shachna was his father-in-law. Unfortunately, they were only married one or two years. When she died, so it could be writes this book here writes that there was a plague, so maybe she died in a plague and during a plague, but it does bring down that she died very young, and on her grave it writes Rabbanis Golda, daughter of Rabbi Meir Rav Shachna, who's may God protect him, means Rav Shachna was still alive at the time. She was only 20 years old, and goes through a tribute of what she had. Okay, the only thing that's very interesting here, it doesn't mention that she was the wife of the chief rabbi of Israel, of Krakow, chief rabbi of Poland, of Lesser Poland, which was the Ramah. So it could be that by this time the Ramah had remarried. So if he was remarried, that could be a reason why they would not put his name on the former wife. I don't know these laws. I just know that they're very spooky, and people like, you know, I mean, I don't mean spooky in a negative way, but, you know, when it comes to, deceased and all the menhagim of burial and cemetery and all these, so they're very strict about certain things. So it could be that he had, by the time they got the tombstone up, he was already either engaged to be married or married, and that's why they left it out. Now, the Ramah, besides being the Gadol Hador, and we're going to see the Posek, I mean, we all, our halacha today really all comes from the Ramah. I mean, that's the basis of it. We and everybody all comes after the Ramah. So that's really, after all said and done, besides all that, he was also a little bit, he was a philosopher, a mystic, an astronomer. So the Marshal finds out that the Ramah was into philosophy. He actually must have sent a letter to the Marshal quoting Aristotle. And when he did that, the Marshal went crazy. He says, "What? Oi, Tyra, Tyra, Chigru, Sak. You know, Torah, gird your loins, tear Kriya, the best of them, they're learning philosophy, what's going to be?" And he writes this letter to the Ramah saying, "How could you do such a thing?" And that, and he goes on and on. So this is the letter of the Ramah responding to the Marshal and all this. I'm just going to, just going just very quickly, I quoted something from the Wisdom of the Greeks. So this whole thing of Greek philosophy or not, this is an old controversy between scholars. I don't have to go into it. You know the response of the Rashba, and even the Rashba, who said you shouldn't do it, he only forbade the study while the person was still in his youth. Mm-hmm. I mean, he probably was somewhat young, but enough of a Talmud, which while a person is still in his youth, before he studied the wisdom of Talmud, which is the meat and wine, who can be considered greater than the Rambam, who wrote this Mora Nevuchim, the Sefer HaMora, the Mora Nevuchim, and even though the Rivash wrote that the Rambam only wrote it to answer heretics, you know, it was a letter. The Mora Nevuchim was a letter to one of his students. This student had to deal with people that were off. I don't know if he had to deal with the Karaites or different sects or the Muslims, that, you know, say so he needed an answer to all these philosophical questions. So the Rivash says the Rambam only really wrote it for them. He didn't really write it for people that were from. He wrote it for them. That's it. But he says even according to the Rivash, he wrote it for the heretics. You already know that the truth is that there are two things. First of all, they're only concerned about the original Rishonim were really only concerned about studying directly from the works of the Greeks, such as Sefer HaShma or Ma Sha'achar HaTeva, which were mentioned there. But in this year, they're justified because you don't want to learn straight from them. They did not forbid studying from scholars their inquiries into the nature and existence of natural law. On the contrary, though, one gets to know the greatness of Hashem. Again, he's responding why he does. And then afterwards, he says, not only that, but we know the Megillah says anyone who states something of wisdom, even from a non-Jew, is called a wise man. And it's, you see, from the Rambam has done it, and the Sefer Akedah has done it. Sorry, I'm going quick on this. It's just... And then the next point is, even if you hold the opinion that they forbade to study from any of their works because we become contaminated, no one ever thought to forbid the works of our own scholars, who we may drink, especially the Rambam. You know, who do you think that the Rambam would write anything that's heretical? You know, and even though some of the scholars disagreed with him and burnt his books, nevertheless, we view him as the crown. The Rambam is like the Rambam. Like, he's passed the test of time. And I, therefore, am innocent from the crime which you accuse me. Although I quoted Aristotle's statements, now he says this is how, when does he study this? You know, you think he has a Seder every day in philosophy? No, he says, first of all, I never studied from his works. I only got it from the Mora Nevuchim and Shara Shamayim. And okay. Also, he writes regarding with the he says that. Okay. Then he writes in the same tshuva. He says, "You also were upset with me for learning Kabbalah." He says, "Learning Kabbalah, like, you know, I would." He says, "Actually, I'd be more afraid of learning Kabbalah without a Rebbe than learning philosophy from the Rambam. That's, you know, there's more dangers in learning Kabbalah." As a matter of fact, one of his Sfarim, the Torah Ha'olah, is a Sefer on Kabbalah. So when he says, when do I learn all this? He says, I only occupy myself in these studies on Shabbos, Yontav, and Chol HaMoed when others are out taking a stroll. The entire week I'm engrossed solely in the study of Mishnah, Talmud, Poskim, and the commentaries. And so why is he saying all this? Why is he telling he's bragging? So he has to write the next line. It's so interesting how they write. A scholar is allowed to make himself known where otherwise he wouldn't recognize him. And he quotes, he doesn't even want to brag without quoting a Gemara saying, I'm allowed to brag because otherwise I have to make a point about this. All right, that was something that the Rama did. He writes, I'm not sure if I have it here. He says, this is in the Torah Sa'ola. So he wrote a Sefer on Kabbalah. Now, unbeknownst to the Rama, maybe he did know, but at the same time in Sfat, which is what we covered last year, the Ari and the Rebbe of the Beis Yosef, I forgot his name, they were studying Kabbalah, and Kabbalah was becoming big, and they were just making it publicly known, but that was with a tradition. Yet in Poland, on halfway across the world, the Rama did not know what they were doing, and he was doing the same thing as well. In Kabbalah, we're going to see the same thing is happening with Halacha as well. But he did not know that there was a rebirth or a rejuvenation of Kabbalah, of the Zohar, from the Ari and the Ramak, Moshe Kordavera. So those two were teaching Kabbalah, and it was becoming very popular in a positive, in a good way. And he didn't know, so he wrote his own Sefer. And he says, I have tremendous trepidation to speak of things which I have not received the tradition. How can I speak of such things if they're only on my logic? I said, Es Lasos Hashem. Why? Because this is because of our sins. The level of generation is diminished to such an extent that I never met a Mekubal, an extra Kabbalist who has a clear understanding of a Kabbalistic concept. And what happens is, this is a picture, this is the Torah Sa'ola that Rav Moshe Isserles, he wrote. This is the upset, right? He says, through our sins, what's happening is people who don't know are learning Kabbalah, and they have no idea of the real concepts and what it's all about. It looks simple, but if you don't have a Rebbe, you don't understand what Kabbalah is, the depth of it, then you're gonna make big mistakes. The intelligent scholar, though, knows that even thinking about these things are fraught with dangers, as the Ramban points out in his commentary on the Torah. He actually, in the Torah Sa'ola, writes, Kabbalah is actually the same wisdom as that of philosophy, only terminology is different. At least that's how his understanding of what Kabbalah and philosophy are coming to the same point from a different starting point.
One would think that he has to have at least some understanding of Kabbalah if he's going to write a Perush on Shulchan Aruch. Because otherwise, it's a shortcoming. How can you possibly really understand?
So I'm not sure about that, because it's very interesting. The Beis Yosef never quoted the Magid, the Malach that spoke to him, or any Kabbalah when it came to Halacha. It almost seems that they separated the two. Like Halacha is Halacha. That's one thing. Halacha, Gemara, that's one thing. Then there's a Kabbalah, there's a hidden type of learning. It maybe comes from a different source. So, it's... the Arizal did try to incorporate, the davening. He made it more Kabbalistic. But in terms of halacha, it almost seems like that it was like a taboo. Halacha is halacha. And just because Kabbalah may come out differently, I mean, we may do certain minhagim because of Kabbalah. But it's not...
Yeah, but my point is, anyone who's at the level that they're going to write a perush on it and understand it well enough... Even though they're not telling us, you have to believe that some of that is coming through and they're understanding it when they're
when they're writing the halacha, they do have some background.
And the same way that Shulchan Aruch didn't write those things down, the person who's doing this also isn't writing it down.
Right.
But I'm sure some
it's like do. So funny, it's like they're paralleling what's going on in Sfat, what's going on in Poland, and they keep beating him to the punch, we'll see very, very shortly. That's how what his understanding is. He also, he writes in the Torah Sa'ola, there's a very good, there's a purpose. What's one of the reasons why he's writing a sefer? Because sometimes there are statements that you have in the Gemara that science, even in those days, just did not understand. It just goes against simple science. So if he says, if you can try to show that it's in concert with science as opposed to against it, then you have a tremendous harvach, you have a tremendous gain. They don't view the Talmud as, they made a mistake here, or they don't know what they're talking about. No, there is a wisdom, but he meant something else, and it's not in contradiction with what we know today. So in other words, he says, for example, the words of Rabbi Yeshua are astounding in the Gemara. How could he say that the sun is in the south by day and the north at night? We know it's east and west. According to the opinion of the scientists and philosophers, none of this is true. That it's a wonderful thing if one could explain to the extent possible the words of our sages in a way that can conform to common knowledge and intelligible and comprehensible. And then he goes ahead and he says, after this much research, and he tries to explain what Rabbi Yeshua's statement is, how to understand it in terms of the rotation of the sun, which is a simple scientific proverb. You know, that's, he says, in the very beginning of Torah Ola, like one of his first things why he's writing the Sefer. Okay, then he also moved. Let's moving over to more halacha. He wrote a sefer called the Torah Chatas. Now, what was the Torah Chatas? The Torah Chatas, he writes like this. It was a sefer that came out Shari Dura from Yitzchak of Durham, which had come out, I think, within 100 years of the Raman. It was a popular sefer because it was like quick psukos in terms of kashrus, especially. You know, this is good. This you could do. This you can't do. And it was a very, very popular sefer and very quick. So the Rama, he felt that he came out with the Torah Chatas, which also has a lot to do with kashrus, with eating. And he felt for two reasons. He says, first of all, that sefer, I want to include more modern-day psukos, like, you know, in the additions to what that is. We almost have, like, something similar in our day. The Mishnah Brura was, you know, finally completed in the year 1930, around 1930s. Each one, it took the Chafetz Chaim 25 years to write it, from beginning to end, all six volumes. And he started when he was 70, around 70. So, you know, he finished around when he was 95, towards the end of his life. And he finished it, and it came out. Now, if you could find Mishnah Brura today, and you'll have, like, editions. Personally, I bought the Dirshu. Dirshu has a Mishnah Brura. It keeps the Mishnah Brura, and then it has modern psukos. Like, there are footnotes on the Mishnah Brura from Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Yashuv and Rav Moshe and, you know, other modern-day shilas that, you know, in the past 100 years, you know, things have evolved and things that the Mishnah Brura himself didn't speak about. So we have other modern-day poskim. Some of them are like, of course, Rav Chaim is still alive, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, you know, the Stipler, the Chazon Ish, all these modern-day poskim. So in the same thing like this, he wanted, that was one of his reasons on laws of Issa v'Heter, to include more modern-day shailas, plus also, and this is a picture of the Torah Chatas, also he's working against Rav Yosef Cairo, not against in a bad sense, but he says Rav Yosef Cairo's works have spread across the entire Jewish world. That was one of the first few books, one of the first books, I think, that was printed with the author was still alive. Okay, so I'm not sure. I think he was still alive when the Shulchan Aruch came out, but because of the printing press, it made its way all around. And the we mentioned last time what the difference, what the Rav Yosef Cairo bases halacha on. But he says the Torah Chatas, because of the popularity of the Shulchan Aruch, or the Beis Yosef, even the first one, the first he came up with the Beis Yosef, and then the Shulchan Aruch, he wanted to put out a book, you know, to counteract, not like the Rav Yosef Cairo, and to add to the Shari Dura. So that was his Torah Chatas. Okay, just now, he also put out in his magnum, I guess, he put out two books. I know I have the preface of the Mappa first, but he was working for many years on coming out with a... First, he was working very many years coming out with a sefer on the Torah. See, the Torah Shulchan Aruch was written by the son of the Rosh. It was written in Spain. It was written in the 1300s. So it was written about 200 years earlier. So he wanted to write a compendium, a perush on that, I guess. And what happened is as he was working, he was spending many years, he's about to finish the Sefer, the Beis Yosef came out. So Mamash, the Beis Yosef, beat him to the punch. Like, and his Sefer came out. What the Beis Yosef wanted to do, what the Beis Yosef did is exactly what the Ramah wanted to do. And he had such chalishas hadas, because what he wanted to do is give a perush, explain the sources. That's the purpose of the Beis Yosef, is to explain the sources of where the Torah got everything from. Where's the Gemara? What's the Sfaros? And, you know, so he felt bad. And then he started reading the Beis Yosef. He says, wait a minute. Beis Yosef doesn't have it all right. Sometimes Beis Yosef, again, he's paskening like the Sfaradim, and we paskin like Ashkenazim. So he wrote his perush. He originally had his sefer, he was going to call the Darkei Moshe. So that he left the entire Darkei Moshe, he called it Darkei Moshe Ha'aruch. And then he wrote a Darkei Moshe, I guess a Katzer, the short Darkei Moshe, which is just in the to respond to the Beis Yosef. So the Beis Yosef, he made a pirush on the Beis Yosef. So instead, you know, when Beis Yosef felt the Beis Yosef was wrong, or he wanted to add to what the Beis Yosef said, that's called the Darkei Moshe. Today, if you look in the Torah, around the Torah, under the Torah, you'll have the Beis Yosef, which is on one side, and the Darkei Moshe. I don't know if the Darkei Moshe made it to the second side, but it made it underneath. So you'll have the Darkei Moshe along with the Beis Yosef. The Shulchan Aruch, the Rav Yosef Karo, afterwards said he wanted to come out with a sefer that was a halacha sefer that everybody could read in 1 month. I mean, the men are laughing because you know what the Shulchan Aruch is today. It's like, and that was supposed to be done in 1 month. So, but if you take out all the mefarshim and you just take a look at just the mechaber, so it could be done in 1 month. And he actually sectioned it off into 30 days, and every 30 days you'd read, you know, the different halachos, and that's it. In 1 month, that's it. You'd be able to go through the 4 Shulchan Aruchs. So that was his next book, and he called it the Shulchan Aruch, the Prepared Table. Now, this made a big rush. Now, he actually, and we did last year, how did he come up with his psak? So how did he come up with his, you know, what did he do? First of all, he fashioned it after the same structure as the Torah, okay? In other words, he used the Torah's structure, the four, dividing all the halachas into 4 parts, Arachayim, Ebenezer, Yeridea, and Choshen Mishpat. He used all that the same. And the only thing, and what he did then is, the way he came up with his psak is he said there are 3 Rishonim that were above and beyond all the others. And that was the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush. And he said, he writes in his preface of the Shulchan Aruch that he followed the majority. So if there was a machlokas between any 2 of them, if 2 of them, he followed what the 3rd one. And if the 3rd one didn't say an opinion, then he would follow from other Rishonim. But that's what that's the way he came up with his psak. Now, the fact that 2 of them, the Rush, oh, I'm sorry, what did I say the 3 were? The Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. The fact that the Rif and the Rambam were Sephardim, and the Rush was Ashkenazi, so you could see already it's going to have a Sephardish bent. Anyway, it hit Europe, it hit Poland, that Sefer, and it caused such a rush. The Marshal writes a letter, a scathing letter. You see the difference between the Ramah and the Marshal. It's the worst thing. People are reading it, and that's not who, you know, that's not the right, who says. In other words, the Ramah says, the tradition in Ashkenazic Jewry was no such thing. They never had a tradition that these 3 are better than everybody else. As a matter of fact, the Ramah writes, in his preface, he writes, the great man wiser, but you see the way he talks in his humility, the Beis Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch, wise men greater than the prophet who prepared a feast and his table is set, did not leave room in which to make improvements with the exception of assembling the opinions of later day authorities and to issue rulings based on the customs of these Ashkenazic lands. Therefore, I've come to spread a tablecloth. He called this thing the Mappa. That was the Shulchan Aruch, is the set table. He called his parish the mappa, the tablecloth. He says this is not this is not yet placed before the people who live in these lands, where the majority of the customary practices are not in concert with his rulings. The earliest generation uses the works. We follow the Ozarua, the Mordechai Rosh Samag, Hagoyes Maimon, which are in turn built on the words of Tosfos, the sages of France, from whom we are descended. So that the evolution of halacha for Ashkenazim all come from Rashi and Tosfos, and the later Rishonim that codified their halachas all the way down to what they did, and nothing to do with the Shulchan Aruch, and that's it. So first the Ramah came in, and then all of the other Mefarshim all are building on what's on the Ramah and the Machabes. So when we say the halacha today, all halachas come today, all comes from the Ramah. It comes from the Ramah. That was the first. So the Ramah added glosses to it. Instead of writing his own sefer, he took the Beis Yosef, and he only added in lines where the halacha was different, or if he felt that the Beis Yosef didn't elaborate enough. So today we have it like in Rashi script or bold and not bold, and that's what we have today. So what they did together is that they also founded one book, one sefer that has the halacha for all of Klal Yisrael, basically. I mean, there may be other like Taimanim or Yemenites, or maybe from the Iraqi Jews or the Persians, that they may not have, they may have had their own traditions, but basically, you know, between Spain, Eretz Yisrael, and Europe, this was all, most of the Jews, for most of the Jews. It's a very bad picture, but this is the Sman, the Shach, these were also from, this in the large, in the block print, in the regular print, that's the Machaber, and you can see in the middle where it's Rashi print, that's the Ramah. It's very unreadable. Here the Ramah adds Hagah, the Ramah adds his words, and the Sman, the Shach, well, you know, they were also in Poland that came after the Ramah, and just, you know, in the Sephardic world, the Ramah did, the Machaber did everything. The Beis Yosef, that was it. There was nothing more to argue with. That was the halacha, and that was the halacha. Maybe, you know, later day halachic, you know, they to add more modern shailas, but in Europe, this was like you know, there's a lot to talk about, and you know, a lot to argue in terms of custom and sources. Again, a preface, the students will come after him and drink up his words without disagreeing, and thereby overturn all the customs of these countries. And that's why he's explaining his purpose, why he made out the sefer of the Machaber. Darki Moshe, this is the other sefer, this is the first one that came out. I almost finished compilation of all the insights of halachic authorities, which arrange an addendum to the Torah. I was gripped with fear and trembling when I heard that you see how he talks about the Machaber, the lamp of Israel, leader of the diaspora, Rabbi Yosef Karo, composed of Beis Yosef, a work in which it's obvious to all is a superior work which immense amount of superb material contained in it. I was concerned that I had toiled all of my sleepless nights in vain. My words compared to those sage, Rabbi Yosef Karo, are insignificant. What use is a lamp in the middle of the day? You know, that's how you see the way he talks. My intention in creating an abbreviated version of my former work is to summarize and to refine the Machaber, like I said. There is one thing I just probably would want to end with. He wrote the Tshuvas HaRamah, so he would always keep a copy for himself. After he wrote the Tshuva, he would have one of his students copy it over and send the copy to the other person. My beloved friend, if you read my letter, please return it back to me, for it's my custom to copy all things that touch on practical halacha. Unlike Rav Shachna and Rav Pollack, they barely wrote anything, but he was into writing. Prima Gadim, preface of Prima Gadim, we have already accepted him as our authority. Shalah, also, the greatest of the later authorities, Adorin Marash Rav Luria, this is the Marshal of Messer Memory, and the Ramah Rav Isselis, Rav Moshe, the Ramah. Public has accepted, however, the Goyen is our master. The Ramah is ruling according to Beis Hillel, despite the fact that Beis Shammai was sharper. Mamish almost like the same thing with Marshal was sharper, but we Paskin like the Ramah. Okay, There was something I wanted, again, the Meir Sinai and the Sma, I studied by my master, the teacher, great authority, Rav Moshe Isserles, devoted, dedicated teacher. He writes, he can't finish, I provided for the needs of Bachram, it takes up a lot of my energy, so I therefore cannot discuss the issues that are not presently absolutely necessary. They're always asking him shailas. If it's not pressing, I have the yeshiva, I have to take care of the boys. Again, I wanted it at the end of his life. There was a famous case that like really changed things. It was the delayed chuppah. That's what it's called. Everybody brings it. Everybody talks about it. It actually changed the custom in Poland because of it. It seems that there was this orphan girl. Originally, she came from a wealthy home. But the father had died at work, and the mother, went crazy, but just she also died young. And she was taken in by one of her relatives, and she was an orphan girl, and they found a shidduch for her, also a boy who was poor from Austria, from far away, and they made the shidduch. Now, as the shidduch went on, they just realized that the dowry that they made up to pay the dowry, and nobody was taking care of the dowry. You know, the uncle that took her in, you know, was making the wedding for her. And then finally, the day of the chasna came, and the chasna's family didn't want to go through with it because there was no dowry. And they were just going back and forth and negotiating. Meanwhile, they had already told her, he writes in the tshuva, that they told the girl to put the veil on. Back then in Poland, the veil wasn't put on by the chasen, by the bedecking, it was put on earlier. So here you had a girl, she was all dressed, she went to the mikvah, she an orphan, no parents, she went to the mikvah, she was in her wedding gown with the veil, and the custom there to save money was to have the wedding on Friday afternoon. You had the chuppah, then they went into, anyway, you had to have a Friday night Shabbos meal and a Shabbos day meal. So it, like, you know, it worked out. That's what they used to do. Meanwhile, the things were getting delayed in terms of trying to get the money for the dowry, and it was going back and forth, and the Rama got involved, and they finally, by the time that they were able to get things going, it was way peshkia. So now what do you do? It's already Friday for Shabbos, and you're not allowed to make a wedding on Shabbos. We don't. It's a kinyan. You know, you don't make a wedding. So the Raman made the wedding. He did the wedding, and he married them. He actually told his shul, "We're not davening until this wedding is done." They all waited until like 2 hours after Shkia. They finally, after the wedding was done, he did the chuppah, married them, and then they first davened Maariv. And he got a lot of grief for that. How could you do it? How could you do it on Shabbos? So he wrote a tshuva on this, and this is English of what the tshuva is. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is like a tshuva, Tshuva's Rama 128. So basically, he basically says like this. He says, first of all, I think he brings a shita of Rabbeinu Tam that you can get married on Shabbos. He says, even though we don't hold like that, but in the case of an emergency, we could. Second of all, you have Rabbeinu Tam. Also, when is Shkia, when is Shabbos? So you have a very, very, very late Zman. Especially in Europe, when, you know, things are, you know, in I guess if it was in the late night, you know, the Shkia is Shos Manios, you have a very, very long time. So he used that as well. Plus, he says if you know, the embarrassment of the Kala here, she wouldn't get married, and who knows, if I wouldn't have married them then, you know, other things would have come up, and she may have never been able to take into the chuppah. Maybe over Shabbos they would have charata and they'd back out and they wouldn't do it. So he felt for the honor of the orphan, you know, not to cause her pain and to make sure that the wedding goes through. And he writes to what he was basing his laws on. He actually sent the letter to Maram Mipadua, and they started giving him a hard time. A lot of the Gedolim, a lot of the Poskim, they said, how could you do it? He was wrong for doing it. He wrote up with his tshuva. Maram Mipadua is also a cousin of his, who was the big Rav in Italy, in Padua. He agreed with the Rama. He got him to agree with the Rama. And that was, you know, I guess it shows the greatness of the Rama, what he was willing to do. They changed the practice in Poland after that, and that no more weddings on Friday. They didn't want it to have to go through what this one did. Anyway, he lived 42, maybe 44 years old. Today, just see if it's... these are different people talking about the... in order to make a fence, he instituted that no chuppah or kedushin should be allowed to conduct it on Friday. And... okay, I don't know. I don't have that. I guess we saw the... it was before we saw his... we saw his gravestone. He's buried today next to the shul. Is the Rama shul? If you, I've been to the shul. I've been to his kever. You can go to the shul. The shul was built in memory of his mother, who also died very young, probably around the same time as his wife, which would mean makes sense that there was a plague there. And you go to next to the shul is a cemetery, and a lot of gedolim are buried there. Tosis Yontif, the Magala Amukos, the Rama. I remember this tour guide told me the Rama. There's a tree by the Rama's grave. It says that the Nazis in Germany, they were looking for his grave, because I guess I don't know what they wanted to do with the Rama. They wanted to destroy it, to do something. And the tree somehow covered the grave. They couldn't find the grave of the Rama. Somehow, I don't know what the tree did, but that's what my tour guide told me. You can go there now in Krakow. It's actually not in really Krakow. It's in Kamenets, if I'm saying it's right. But this was a suburb of Krakow. The Jews were not, for a time, they were not permitted to live in Krakow. They were permitted to, Kamenets was a suburb. It was actually an island. And the Magali Amukos, I don't know if I mentioned it last time, I think I did, there was a child that was drowned in the river, and they blamed the Jews of drowning the Gaiish child. And the Magali Amukos, it happened once for a Jewish child, and then a second time, and he says, the Magali Amukos said, didn't I tell you not to let any children drown? And that was it, and then it all dried up. At least it didn't become instead of it becoming an island, two of the rivers or whatever around Kamenets dried up, and now it was part of the mainland. And when you go there, it's a big, massive street, and there are stores there and big highways, and they say this was originally the riverbed. You could see it. Mr. Hashem, if you ever go to Krakow, it's a beautiful place there to go there. All right, the Rama again. He's the he was the leader of Polish Jewry, and he made definitely. We all today are all benefiting from the Rama.